Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And we're trying to secure our guest right now. So let me talk about another topic before I talk about what I hope we'll talk about. Because if we didn't talk about what I hope we talk about, I'd be wasting some time. First of all, let me tell you that, as you well know, today is Election Day. There are 6 recall elections in the state of Wisconsin. And at 8 o'clock tonight, we will have special election coverage on the Ideas Network. Wisconsin Public Radio's state government reporter Sean Johnson and Wisconsin Public Television reporter Adam Schrager will be talking with analysts, with reporters around the state, and I'm sure with some of the candidates themselves about the results of Tuesday's recall election. That's tonight, beginning at 8 o'clock here on the Ideas Network. And rest assured, we'll be talking about this on many of our programs tomorrow. Joy, I'm sure, will have guests analyzing the results, and we will have, during our 9 o'clock hour tomorrow, a guest, or several guests, actually, who will analyze what happened in Wisconsin today. So we invite you to tune in for all of those discussions. And you can always go to WPR Facebook page. You can go and find out what all the shows are. And we all have our individual Facebook pages as well, and we update those every day as to who's going to be on the show tomorrow. Mine is the Kathleen Dunn Show. So if you go there, you can find out what will be on the agenda for tomorrow. And you can do that today as soon as the shows are booked. We try to get right on Facebook and let you know what those subjects and guests are going to be. So we should have our guest. We got in contact with a publicist who's giving our guest a call, so we hope that we'll have him in a moment, because it's a really interesting and darned important topic. And I'll tell you about it in a moment. Is there anything else I have to say? Oh, I will say this once again. I said it last hour, and then I won't say it anymore. We're having a reunion this Saturday of the people who went on the Washington, D.C. trip, with a few additions. And I fear that I may not have been able to get a hold of everybody. I hope that I have. So we figure that at least one of you who was on the trip will tell somebody else who was on the trip. And before you know it, everybody who was on the trip will be reminded that the gathering is in Toma this Saturday. Anytime after 10 a.m. is A-OK. We're going to swim and eat and talk and share pictures. So if you didn't get the information, give our station a call, 414-227-2040, and I'll chat with you about all of the details for that fun get-together. And that's that. All right, I'll intro the show. I hope we can do it. Christian Parenti, we hope, will be joining us momentarily. Christian has written one whale of a book, Tropic of Chaos, Climate Change and the New Geography of Violence. It's my understanding that he has spent the past 6 years traveling to parts of the country that have been economically and politically battered, and now they are dealing with climate change, and that exacerbates the political problems. The book is the Tropic of Chaos, which he describes, is a belt of economically and politically battered post-colonial states that straddle the planet's mid-latitudes. And he connects climate change to violence, humanitarian crises, and social breakdown and spreading state failure. And this is only to be a larger and larger problem. He cites the number of people in this country, on this planet, who are feeling the effects of climate change to be 2.7 billion people, and that's 46 countries. And the effects will be increasing. They already are, more rapidly than we thought they were going to. So it's going to be a larger and larger problem. And we also see what's going on in Somalia. He includes Somalia, and this book was written well before the famine that is currently affecting that country. He looks at individual deaths and tries to trace climate change and the death being caused in part by climate change. So as you can imagine, it's important. Another big part of the book looks at how the global north is responding to the violence and the chaos of the global south with a new authoritarianism, and how the U.S. is preparing for a world remade by climate change. He cites the number of reports, Pentagon report, Australian reports, that are really planning for a kind of Armageddon. So that's what's happening this hour. And we did find Christian. Christian is contributing editor at The Nation. He is a Puffin Foundation writing fellow at The Nation Institute, a visiting scholar at the City University of New York, and in sociology from the London School of Economics. He's the author of other books, Lockdown America, The Soft Cage, and The Freedom. And he has written for a number of publications. We'll be welcoming phone calls. The number is 800-486-8655. The email address is talk@wpr.org. talk@wpr.org. Hello, Christian. Thank you very much for being with us.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me on.
Yeah. Whoa, what a book this is. You had so much to take on here and so many years of preparation. Tell me where you have traveled in the last 6 years.
Well, I've been to Iraq, Afghanistan, several countries in West Africa and East Africa, India, you know, parts of Latin America. And not all of them were part of the book. I mean, some of them were just for magazine articles that preceded the book, but a lot of those trips then kind of fed into the book. But then there was a whole series of trips that I took just for the book, which included Kenya, India, Brazil, Mexico, and Afghanistan.
Mm-hmm. It's remarkable, isn't it? And you must even be struck by this, although you knew it before we did, how some of the countries that you highlight, like Somalia, have become front and center in terms of 60-year droughts and horrible famine occurring as a result of that.
Yeah. It's. I mean, unfortunately, a lot of what I've argued in the book has become increasingly, has been validated by recent events. I mean, there's the famine in Somalia. I was on the border with Somalia and in northern Kenya 3 years ago, and people were talking about this drought and essentially about famine and how they were headed towards serious famine. And I have a chapter in the book where I was visiting Somali refugees, well, not refugees, Somali Kenyans near the Somali border, and there was, you know, absolutely no economic activity going on there. The drought was so bad that all their herds had died, and they were existing solely on aid. So, yeah, on the ground, people saw this coming, and now we see it, you know, coming to fruition in ugly ways. And then since the book has been published, I followed up on some of these stories. The drought in the Black Sea area caused Russia to ban all of its grain exports, and Ukraine and Kazakhstan cut back as well. That caused food prices in Egypt, the largest wheat importer in the world, to surge by 20%. You know, and this is a contributing factor in the Arab Spring. These are all things that were just beginning to happen when the book was finally being put to bed, as it were. And so, yes, it's the patterns are holding true of climate-driven violence. I mean, not climate change as the only cause of violence, but climate change as an increasingly important contributing factor to violence.
Talk, Christian, about this convergence, and you've mentioned parts of it, this catastrophic convergence, and you say there are three forces at work here. Each is pretty bad, but put them together and you've got a catastrophe.
Right. Climate change very rarely just works in isolation. And in the global south, it arrives on a stage preset for crisis. And the forces that have preset that stage are primarily Cold War-era militarism, which has left much of the global south littered with guns and men who know how to use them and traumatized communities, and also radical free market economic restructuring, let's say neoliberal economic restructuring, as pushed by the World Bank and IMF. And that, over the last 30 years, has meant that government in the global south has withdrawn its support for common people. And so in northern Kenya, the pastoralists that are now shooting it out over water holes and trying to steal each other's cattle to survive in the face of this drought are doing so in part because they don't have any government assistance programs, or they have very, very few government assistance programs to fall back on. There isn't the agricultural extension programs, the veterinary extension programs that once existed. There are programs to help drill new water holes. All of this has been reduced in the name of market efficiency and allowing the free market to solve all problems, and thus for Kenya to get its books in order and pay off its debts. And that story is repeated over and over throughout the Global South. But so then you get the worst drought in 60 years. The place is flooded with cheap guns left over from the Cold War. Mm-hmm. There's no government support, so people fall back on the means at hand, which are cheap weapons and going after your neighbor's water hole or your neighbor's cattle.
One could say the support for the common person is fairly absent in developed countries these days as well.
Increasingly so, yeah. I mean, that's the core of the issue we're dealing with here around the debt ceiling. I mean, the austerity that's been imposed in developed economies like the UK and ours and Greece is, you know, essentially the same set of questions about trying to remove government from, you know, to strip away the social safety net and strip away any role for government planning and guidance and regulation within the economy. And that has been shown again and again to lead to increased inequality and increased absolute poverty. Sometimes it also leads to high rates of growth, as in India, but generally it leads to stagnation. I mean, that was the experience of Latin America after 20 years and during 20 years of neoliberalism. And I think we see that actually in this country too, that austerity instead of stimulus is going to mean more stagnation.
Mm-hmm. You, and I wasn't aware of this, you later in the book talk about Pentagon studies and many other studies, and studies that are not just coming from the United States but from other countries, really kind of outlining a coming Armageddon. Why weren't those studies front and center? Why, and when were they written, and what do they say?
Well, they were, I mean, they were not, I mean, there's some that were secret, but they're not all secret, and they were public information, and they were even reported on a bit. I mean, why they were not a bigger deal, I can't really explain that. That's probably, you know, that's media criticism and psychological analysis. But I mean, the information was put out there, and the fact of the matter is, the Pentagon takes climate science very seriously. The main body for vetting climate science internationally is the UN's Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the IPCC, and the IPCC has been attacked by the Koch brother funded kind of network of climate denialists and Rupert Murdoch's papers. And they did make a few errors in their fourth assessment report, which is their last big report. But when those errors were corrected, the overall findings of the assessment report were not affected. In other words, the errors were not consequential. But the IPCC has come under attack from the right in recent years. But what the IPCC does is it doesn't create science of its own. It's a clearinghouse that vets all of the best science from universities and government agencies and think tanks around the world. And industry and government and science have to work out a consensus on what is considered the prevailing best knowledge on climate change and how it works and what its effects will be. And over the course of these four assessment reports that come out every 4 years, the IPCC has become more and more worrying in its findings. And it's what's become clear is that climate change is happening, that it is driven by human society's burning of fossil fuels, and that we need to stop that as soon as possible, or we could possibly hit tipping points after which the process can become self-reinforcing. The natural process of the planet warming would be set off. So an example of that is the melting of the Arctic permafrost. That's a result of anthropogenic-driven climate change. But once the the permafrost melts to a certain point, it then releases methane that's trapped beneath it. Once there's this release of natural methane, that's a process that would then be out of our control. Burning coal and driving climate change, that's a process that's within our control. So right now, that's the primary driver of climate change, and we need to deal with it before the primary driver of climate change becomes the knock-on effects, the positive feedback loops set off by climate change. So anyway, the Pentagon takes the IPCC's findings very seriously, and they have run scenarios about the future, and what they see is a future of increased civil war and religious warfare and banditry, internal conflict within states, particularly in the global south, and they realize that the armed services will be called upon to intervene in these conflicts, and so that puts counterinsurgency, counterterrorism, low-intensity conflict at the center of their agenda, and they are planning for this. And to their credit, they take the science very seriously. Also, to their credit, the military, you know, the military does not make policy, it implements it. And to their credit, they do not have illusions about the power of a military response to climate change. They say in these reports again and again, we can, this is even in the best case scenario, we're locked in for a certain level of disruption. We're going to be called upon to do this. This is how we should deal with it. We can handle it for a couple of decades, but if it's just business as usual and there is no attempt to deal with the root cause of the problem, then all bets are off. And even the most powerful nations in the world, including ours, will face natural crises that will be impossible to manage militarily.
Mm. Let's go to Afghanistan for a moment, where we already have forces and things aren't going very well. Tell me how climate change may be exacerbating the political instability that is already evident, and what might be a better approach for us to deal with the instability.
Well, yeah, in Afghanistan, it's where the book, the idea of the book came to me, and I was researching the opium trade, the growing opium poppy from which comes heroin. And the Karzai government and the NATO forces attack opium, and the Taliban support the farmers' right to grow it. And I was asking farmers, well, why do you grow this risky crop? And again, part of the answer was, it's very drought-resistant. And at the time I first started reporting on opium poppy in 2004, I didn't even know there was a drought in Afghanistan. Turns out Afghanistan is living through the worst drought in living memory. Mm. And poppy uses 1/6 to 1/5 the water that wheat requires per acre. So given the drought conditions in Afghanistan, opium poppy is the only economically feasible crop available. And in this war where one side attacks opium and the other side supports it, the drought then becomes one more cause in driving young men into the arms and the ranks of the Taliban. Because along with the ideological and ethnic motivations they might have for joining the Taliban, there's this economic incentive which is linked to the drought, which is climate-driven, or at least fits the pattern that climate scientists have predicted for that region. And that is that the only way they can survive in the face of the drought is to grow the illegal crop. One side in the war defends the illegal crop, the other side attacks it. So when a young man joins the Taliban, among other things, he may, in fact, be supporting his family's right to survive under these extreme climatic conditions. So from there, I went, you know, looking for other examples of how climate change, not in the future down the line, but already is contributing to instability. And sure enough, in many, many conflicts, there are significant climatological aspects to it. In terms of what would be a better response, I mean, the dealing with mitigation, cutting carbon emissions, and adaptation, coming up with ways for farmers to adapt to the more extreme climates they're facing would be a better way. But in Afghanistan, realistically speaking, I mean, the problem is so intractable there. The Afghan government is so profoundly corrupt and incompetent that it'd be a much larger discussion to get into what a realistic policy in Afghanistan would be.
Yeah. Switch to Mexico, where you highlight fishermen whose fish have been affected by climate change, who winds up thinking the only place to make some money is to get involved in drugs.
Mm-hmm. Yes, in Mexico, again, I'm not arguing that climate change is the driving factor behind the drug war in northern Mexico, but that it's increasingly a contributing factor. I mean, all reputable studies, the UN, the UK government's Stern report, they predict that by the mid-later part of this century, as much as 10 times as many people as are currently on the move could be on the move.
Wow.
As climate refugees. And there's currently about 25 million people, you know, wandering homeless internationally as in any given day right now. So, I mean, that could go up considerably. I mean, some estimates are even much higher than that, that, you know, by the later part of this century, there could be, you know, hundreds and hundreds of millions of climate refugees. So in Mexico, what you see are sort of the advance guard of climate refugees. Mexico is suffering the worst drought in 60 years, punctuated by freak flooding. But all of this environmental crisis is happening on a stage preset for crisis by free trade, by NAFTA. And NAFTA had essentially stripped away all the old government supports and protections that Mexican farmers and fishermen relied on. So this guy that I met in Juarez, who was looking, you know, north into the U.S., where he had gotten a job as a roofer, but then had been deported, and he wanted to get back to his job, and he had no money, and he had no way to get across the now militarized border without getting coyote, a guide, and he needed money to do that, and probably the only way he could get money, he figured, was to get involved in the drug trade, and he didn't want to do that, he didn't know what to do. And his story was that he was from Michoacan, and in the late 90s, there was an El Nino event, and the warm water caused an algae bloom, which was itself partly produced by those same free trade policies on land that were cutting down mangroves, promoting large export farming, and building hotel resorts, and deregulating the economy to the point where these businesses didn't have to clean their water before they flushed it into the sea. So all of this, together with the sudden surge in warm water, creates this toxic algae bloom, drives the fish away. This fisherman doesn't have any kind of social safety net to fall back on, so he borrows money on the open market. He can't pay it off because the fish never rebound. He has to sell his skiff and his nets, and he moves north. And so you can see how that, you know, is he an economic refugee or is he a climate refugee? Obviously, it's a bit of both, because these things are intertwined. And now, as a climate refugee of sorts, he's potentially a recruit to the drug war, which is really, I mean, calling what's going on in northern Mexico a drug war is almost to make it sound more coherent than it is, because wars typically have one or two or maybe, you know, two or three sides to them. But in Mexico, it's much more fragmented and chaotic, and there's a real just total breakdown of law and order in some of those northern cities like Juarez. So, you know, his story is repeated again and again in that region. I found other people while I was there, Tarahumara Indians, who had been, you know, driven out of their homeland in the south by drought that had devastated their forests and made farming really hard, and they too were in Juarez, and there are no jobs there really. And the easy way to make money, particularly if you're young, is get involved in the drug trade.
And probably have a much shorter life. Christian Parenti is our guest. His book is Tropic of Chaos: Climate Change and the New Geography of Violence. We have lines open if you'd like to join our conversation. The number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655 for you to be a part of the conversation. He talks about in the book, it's a, there are a lot of levels to this book, the catastrophic convergence of the legacy of Cold War militarism, neoliberal economic restructuring, and the onset of climate change. He traveled to many of the countries where this is manifesting itself, and also spends a good part of the book looking at how The global north is responding to the violence and chaos with a new kind of authoritarianism. So it takes on a lot. We welcome your phone calls. He does have answers and calls for action on climate change, and we'll talk about those as we carry on. 800-486-8655. Email is talk@WPR.org. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Christian Parenti, our guest. He's a contributing editor at The Nation, a Puffin Foundation writing fellow at The Nation Institute, visiting scholar at the City University of New York. His PhD is in sociology from the London School of Economics, and his latest book is Tropic of Chaos, Climate Change and the New Geography of Violence. Let's go to phone calls. Steve in Wanakee is our first caller. Hi, Steve.
Hi. I've traveled some, not extensively, but particularly in Central America. And what I encountered there, among other things, with their political upheaval was were the effects of deforestation. I mean, there are many people living very basic lives with the resources that are at hand, and across the isthmus from Guatemala through Nicaragua and other places, it just seems apparent that that drought and lack of water resources is a problem. Does that come into play in Afghanistan as well? I mean, I can imagine
deforestation. Yes, definitely. Deforestation is a problem in Afghanistan, and it's a very old problem too. I mean, Gore province, this in the center of Afghanistan, which is one of the most environmentally battered. I mean, its deforestation crisis actually goes back to the Middle Age. It was the metal melt. It was sort of the metal ore region of Afghanistan, and so they cut down all the trees to smelt the ore, and then it became a cattle herding region and exported cattle to the rest of Afghanistan, and now it really looks like the moon. So sometimes these problems of deforestation are very, very old. But then also they can be exacerbated by bad economic policies that don't provide alternative livelihoods to peasants who then go off and log illegally. And you find a lot of that going on in Kenya, which is another section that I deal with in the book. And in Central America, land grabbing, semi-legal and illegal land grabbing for development is a big problem in terms of driving deforestation. And deforestation is a local environmental crisis that, you know, it's a short-term form of adaptation for many people to cut down the trees they have to just mine out the resources of their landscape. But and it then contributes to the problem by allowing more aggressive erosion when hurricanes and heavy rains come. So it's an important piece of the equation, and it's an important way that people in the global south can both adapt and mitigate the problem simultaneously, because obviously trees absorb CO2. And I found an example of that in Brazil, in northeastern Brazil, which is an extremely kind of arid climate to begin with, semi-arid climate, and it's taking a hit from climate change with this pattern of extreme drought punctuated by freak flooding. And some farmers there are beginning to really use an integrated system of tree-based farming that they call agroecological forestry. And it is having a very, you know, very positive effect in terms of restoring the fertility of the land, helping to trap water within the landscape, and creating higher incomes for the farmers. But interestingly, you know, that sort of stewardship of the land that is embodied in nurturing trees rather than just cutting them down and getting rid of them is very closely linked to social justice. If farmers in the global south have access to resources and have rights to land, they're much more likely to take care of it than if they are marginalized and denied ownership of land. In other words, we need land redistribution. So in Brazil, I found this one community that was organized by the MST, which is the Landless Peasant Movement in Brazil, on one side of this road in the valley, they owned their land, and they were practicing the agroecological forestry methods there. On the other side of the road, they had occupied portions of an Italian, absentee Italian landlord's cattle ranch. And there, it turned out, after hanging out with them for a couple of days, they were using traditional modern methods of monocropping, burning, clearing away the shrub and trees, exposing the land and planting monocrops. And they were sort of, you know, chagrined about this contradiction. And when I asked them, they explained, well, you know, we could be thrown out of here at any day by the cops, and we don't have the room to invest the several years necessary to use the agroecological forestry methods. So we just have to get whatever profit we can from this land while we're trying to win title to it. And if we had title to it, we could take better care of it. So to my mind, that was a perfect encapsulation of how social policy and environmental policy in the Global South really need to go hand in hand.
Yeah. Let's spend a few more minutes on environmental policy, because your book leads a person to believe that there is really some urgency about all of this, and that governments need to take action quite soon, or things are going to be just awful on this planet. Do you see any hopeful signs? You talk about maybe a move for natural gas. Do you see that happening? Do you see...
I'm not advocating natural gas. There's one thing I say in the book, which is about fuel switching. So if we were serious about reducing our carbon emissions by 80% over the next 30 years, the very first thing we would do is we would switch all existing coal plants to natural gas, because that requires hardly any retrofitting. It's expensive to store the natural gas. That's why utilities don't want to do it, in part. But that, if we did that, that alone would reduce the U.S. overall carbon footprint by like 13%, I believe is the number. Now, that's not to defend natural gas. Natural gas, especially when it's shale gas rather than petroleum gas, is highly destructive often in its extraction through fracking. But that's not the only place natural gas comes from. It comes up with oil all the time. And the solution is not to burn natural gas, but as a bridging fuel, as an emergency stopgap measure on the way to getting rid of coal plants, it's a realistic bridging fuel. And then shut down those now gas-fired, formerly coal plants, shut them down as conservation reduces emission, and as conservation reduces demand for power, and as new clean sources of power such as wind and solar come online. So this is what we would be doing if we were serious about making these cuts. The other thing, I mean, that I do at the end of the book rescue the reader from possible doom and gloom, feelings of doom and gloom, is to point out what can be done right now without Congress passing any new legislation or approving any new spending to deal with the climate crisis. There's lots and lots that can be done. First and foremost, the EPA has the responsibility to regulate greenhouse gas emissions under the Clean Air Act. This was a fight that began in the late 90s and finally culminated in the Supreme Court in 2007. The Supreme Court said, yes, greenhouse gas emissions like CO2 are covered under the Clean Air Act. Therefore, the EPA is required to regulate them. And we're only now beginning to get the rules issued for what that would mean. And the EPA is dragging its feet. If the EPA were robust and aggressive in how it issued these rules, it could essentially impose a de facto carbon tax on refining oil, burning coal, these sorts of highly polluting processes. If that were done, that would help drive private investment away from old, dirty fossil fuels towards clean energy. This is exactly why the Republicans are so adamantly attacking the EPA, because they realize the EPA actually has a lot of power to help transform the economy in a very positive way. And that transformation, by the way, would help create jobs, and it would help create profits in new sectors. But it definitely would hurt coal and oil and certain sectors of American industry that have sunk capital in the form of oil pipelines and oil refineries, like, for example, the Koch brothers. I mean, those interests would be hurt by this transition. The economy as a whole would not be hurt. The economy as a whole would benefit. So there's a lot the EPA could do. We're waiting for 30 of those rules to be issued, and people should pressure the EPA and the Obama administration to make sure that those rules are robust and have a positive effect. The other thing that could be done, the state and federal governments of the United States together constitute over one-third of U.S. GDP. The federal government has the largest fleet of buildings in the country, the largest fleet of vehicles. It's the largest single consumer of power. If the federal government used its purchasing power to buy clean energy, buy electric vehicles, and retrofit and convert its buildings so that they use less energy and possibly in some cases even produced energy, that would have a positive effect directly. It would help reduce the carbon footprint of the U.S. government, a large part of the U.S. economy, but it would also have positive effects indirectly. It would help create large economies of scale for the burgeoning clean tech sector, which currently suffers for lack of markets. So, for example, I interviewed for an article in The Nation, the one company in this country that makes electric trucks, delivery trucks, and they say they could reduce their costs by at least 20% if they ordered their parts in batches of 100 rather than batches of 10. But they don't have sufficient orders because the market isn't big enough yet. Government purchasing of electric vehicles could help create markets that would help reduce costs so that electric vehicles would then become cost competitive with fossil fuel-driven vehicles. And when that happens, then the private sector and private individuals will begin making the transition because it will be economically feasible and, in many cases, economically more profitable.
So,
those are things that can happen without getting John Boehner to believe in the science of climate change, without getting Congress to allocate any new money. This is money the federal government will buy new vehicles for the post office, period.
Right.
Now, will they be electric or will they be gasoline powered? That's the question.
Well, who's making that decision and why haven't they decided just as a matter of course? Well, this would be a good thing to do. Let's just do it.
Well, to Obama's credit, he has issued an executive order telling federal agencies to start devising plans to develop clean purchasing programs. That's been delayed in certain cases. And again, it's because of this pushback from the very anti-green elements within the Republican Party who are, dead set against seeing any kind of a transition away from fossil fuels towards a new clean industrial sector. So it's been delayed and it's somewhat stalled out, but there has been a very positive executive order and the process begun. What needs to happen is that needs to become front and center and receive a lot more attention and not be allowed to die on the vine.
Right. Christian Parenti is our guest. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. And the book is Tropic of Chaos, Climate Change and the New Geography of Violence. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Recall elections, as you know, are taking place in parts of Wisconsin today. Tonight at 8, we will have special election coverage on the Ideas Network. Sean Johnson, who's our state government reporter, and Wisconsin Public Television reporter Adam Schrager will be speaking with analysts and reporters around the state and with people who win and lose about the results of Tuesday's recall elections. That's tonight at 8 o'clock. Here on the Ideas Network, and tomorrow we'll have talk programming devoted to the results of the vote on many of our shows. Let's go back to phone calls. Our next caller is Joe in Milwaukee. Hi, Joe.
Hi, Kristen. Thanks for your work, man. This is really something here. Hey, are you related to Michael Parenti?
I am, yes. Yeah, he's my father.
Holy cow, I'd like to be at that dinner table a couple times. Listen, I got a question for you here. Capitalist economies rely on growth. Our finite resources cap that growth. Mm-hmm. How are we going to reconcile that contradiction?
I deal precisely with that question at the end of the book. And what I do is basically take a pass on that question. Marx and Engels, they come up with this idea of a metabolic rift between capitalism and nature. That it's a very minor part of their thinking, but it's been sort of like excavated out and shown that there was this environmental issue in their thinking, and that they argue that at a certain point, nature is finite and capitalism could potentially grow infinitely. So that alone is a kind of fundamental contradiction. Many environmentalists, on the left, and people embrace this idea without embracing the language of capitalism or any kind of Marxist language. I mean, Bill McKibben talks about the growth economy, but what is that? I mean, which economy is it that we're talking about that's addicted to growth? It's capitalism. So it's all throughout the environmental movement, this issue of growth. Now, what also happens is that people confuse the climate crisis with all other environmental crises. The climate crisis, because of its scale and magnitude, can easily appear to be the sum total of all environmental crises. But it is, in fact, not. It is a subset. And it is a subset of the larger set of crises that is operating on an extremely compressed time frame. So what I argue is that we have to be realistic about dealing with this one crisis and break it out. And if we're realistic about the time frame of what the science says, it means that this society now, as it is, with these institutions, must come up with a solution. So that means capitalism has to come up with a solution to the climate crisis. That doesn't solve the crisis, the myriad other environmental crises of over depletion of the sea, the proliferation of toxic chemicals in the environment, on and on and on. There are many other environmental crises, the overuse of water, But so it doesn't solve those crises. But what it does do, it would buy us time to deal with those crises and to carry on. And the fact of the matter is, in case listeners don't know, climate science is very clear that from the Ice Age onward, concentrations of CO2 in the atmosphere hovered at around 280 parts per million. With the onset of the Industrial Revolution, that begins to go up. We're now at 390 parts of CO2 per million in the atmosphere. It's pretty clear that after 350 parts per million, we begin to hit dangerous tipping points where feedback loops get set off, positive feedback loops that have negative effects. So the reduction, heat reduces the amount of ice in the Arctic. The less ice there is in the Arctic in the summer, the less heat is reflected back out into space, thus the faster becomes the heating. Those types of positive feedback loops where the effect of the original cause feeds back to compound the cause. So we have to deal with this crisis in the time frame that science tells us, which is immediately. We have a few decades to deal with this, and if we don't, we're going to be in very, very deep trouble. So that's how I deal with that question of capitalism and its possible fundamental conflict with the limits of nature. Capitalist society, through regulation, through the intervention of people organizing politically, has dealt with environmental crises in the past. We have cleaned up our water. We have cleaned up our air. It's not completely clean by any means, but, water quality in the U.S. has improved over the last 40 years because government regulation has stepped in and prevented industry from dumping toxic and polluting chemicals into our water. So we have examples. Our cities have been cleaned up over the last 100 years through the same thing, people coming together in movements and creating government policies that prevent the abuse of the environment. So there are solutions through policy, through collective action. But I think it is important to break out the climate crisis, see it as an emergency that has to be dealt with now, and to realize that is not the same as dealing with some of the bigger, more profound, existential, sometimes philosophical questions about society and the environment. And it is imperative not to confuse the two, because some people in the environmental movement argue, well, the way to solve the climate crisis is to transform society so that it is fundamentally different. Some people would call it revolution. Some people wouldn't like that word and would just talk about transformation, a local economy, whatever it is. But, you know, fundamentally, that's not realistic. That's not going to happen in the next 20 or 30 years. Capitalism, capitalist firms making profits using modern technology to shift away from fossil fuels towards clean technology, that could happen. That is, in fact, already happening. That is a process that is already underway. It's just not happening fast enough.
Joe, thanks for the call. Mike in Sheboygan, hi.
Hi, just a quick comment and a question. Comment is that I don't necessarily see capitalism as the problem. I see globalism as the problem, where capitalist economies can unfairly sometimes export the risk and the liabilities of their commercial activity across borders. And so essentially they don't have to live with the excess that a capitalist economy produces. The question is, and it's a wonderful guest, is how, I mean, I don't know if it's a function of law verbiage or what, but it seems like the Chinese dominate green tech manufacturing. And I'm just wondering, retooling the U.S. economy, how do we, how do we keep those jobs here? How do you say, without being too protectionist, that we first have to look to indigenous business to provide for those needs, because China owns, you know, so many patents on advanced battery technologies. They own the raw materials, et cetera. Yeah. I'd love to see it. I just don't know how we do that without the Chinese stepping in, flooding our markets, and we're right back to square one.
Well, I think that's an excellent question. I mean, I think there are a number of things that could be done. I mean, what I laid out earlier about the big green buy, as my colleague Mark Hertzgarb and I call this, the idea of government purchasing as driving clean tech, that would be very important. That would be a form of de facto industrial policy that would create markets for clean tech in this country. The U.S. has despite our rhetoric around free trade, the U.S. has some of the most aggressive national purchasing quotas in the world. This is hardly ever discussed, but the necessity to buy American in government purchasing is more robust in this country than it is in France or Japan. So, and we do that for patriotic reasons. We might as well do that for clean tech reasons as well. So there's a lot that could be done if the investment is made and government policy can help guide that. The EPA regulations that increase the price of carbon emissions will also help drive private investment into the clean tech sector. Then also, this is a little more difficult, but this is what China does. It subsidizes. It plans and it subsidizes its industrial sectors. If it wants to develop a car industry, it uses hothouse government policy and subsidized loans to do that. That's what it's doing with its wind sector and its solar sector as well. And the U.S. should do that as well. But, I mean, unfortunately, we have such a demented political discourse in this country that has developed over the last several decades, where there's total denial about the real history of how American capitalism developed. And the fact of the matter is, American capitalism developed always with the helping hand of the American state. The idea that American government is a fetter on private industry is simply not warranted by a look at history. So we need to embrace that reality, and we need to re-legitimize the idea of government planning and government subsidies. And we should be subsidizing our clean tech sector much more than we do. There's one battery factory in the U.S. I'm not even sure it's really up and running. I think it's kind of in the developmental stage, and it's surviving on a $30 million grant or loan from the federal government. That's nothing compared to what the Chinese do. And unfortunately, what happened in response to that, in response to the Chinese subsidies to their clean tech sector? The AFL-CIO, Richard Trumka, head of the AFL-CIO, urged the Obama administration to take China to the WTO, to essentially take them to international court, to get them to stop subsidizing their clean tech sector, which is, first of all, ridiculous because the Chinese aren't going to stop. But also pathetic because Richard Trumka couldn't say, hey, we need to be competitive with the Chinese. Why aren't we getting levels of subsidies for our industries here? Why aren't we having a reindustrialization of the Rust Belt based on clean tech? and helped, as the original industrialization was, with government contracts and government purchasing and government subsidies and regulations when necessary. And that proposal wasn't even really made. Instead, they went after China. So, I mean, the problem is we just don't have the political discourse. But the good news is, look, we have the technology, wind, solar, hydroelectric, electric vehicles, all of this stuff is online. We have a grid. The grid needs to be upgraded. Plug in clean power at one end and hyper-efficient buildings and hyper-efficient electric vehicles at the other end. We have money. The U.S. federal government is, you know, not broke. It has cut taxes on the rich. If we raised taxes to what they were historically on the top sectors of this country, there would be plenty of money.
And on that note, we have to say goodbye to you, Christian, because we're out of time. Thank you, Christian Parenti, our guest. The book is The Tropic of Chaos, Climate Change, and the New Geography of Violence. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing the hour. Thanks to Christy Pease for on-air production here in our downtown Milwaukee studios. A reminder, election coverage, 8 o'clock tonight on the Ideas Network, and we'll spend the first hour of our program tomorrow responding to how you voted today. Thanks for listening.